Welcome to the Great IO Get-Together. On tonight's show, quips and queries about the world of work as IO psychology comes alive. Now please welcome our hosts, Richard and Taryn.
All right, hi everybody. Welcome to gig number 27. This season, the gig's a little different from the past. Taryn and I are going to be spending each episode exploring key concepts from our recent textbook, Research Methods in Industrial Organizational Psychology. This week, we are exploring chapter one, Becoming a Researcher, Becoming an IO Psychologist, which is all about what being an IO psychologist means in terms of philosophy and identity and ethics and beyond. So with us in the studio today are Lieta Hugh and Fred Oswald. So to get started, I'd like our audience to kind of get a sense of who you two are and also how you're related to each other. So to start, could you describe who you are and your work and maybe speak a little bit about your work relationship? I don't know who wants to go first.
Lieta, over to you.
I've been in the field working for over 50 years, 54 actually. And I have specialized in measuring work, people, and performance. And that has led me to any number of very interesting work assignments. I have focused specifically on personnel selection, promotion, performance appraisal, and compensation. Most recently, I've been working on that. I have been extremely fortunate in my career, and I attribute my good fortune to the training I got at the University of Minnesota. I mean, it's been incredibly important. I learned about differential psychology, individual differences that includes cognitive abilities, interests, personality, all the ways in which people differ. Learned research methods, how to go about learning about information and developing new knowledge. And I learned about measurement. I learned social psychology. Minnesota is very broad. And anyway, that trained me to do what I do today. And I continually look back to materials that I studied in graduate school and throughout the last 50 years, because one of the important things is, of course, to stay up to date and to find new information that's relevant to what you're doing. I've studied personality in depth, and I like to think I've been instrumental in the fact that personality variables are being used today extensively. When I first started, you were a charlatan if you were using personality variables. And I was really lucky to be involved in a major research project called Project A. It was a consortium project with the Army, and we were developing new expanded ways of measuring people and work and their performance. And I was assigned the non-cognitive area, and we organized information in new ways that this literature had not been organized before in terms of constructs. And that led to discovering relationships that were meaningful. And that led to my publishing up quite a bit over the years in the area of personality. So what are my takeaways from having been so fortunate is that really grab the opportunities as they present themselves. Fred, so how did Fred and I get? Well, I'll let Fred describe himself.
Lieta was an opportunity that presented herself when I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. So a lot of what she said applies to me in terms of well-rounded psychological training, training individual differences and measurement broadly in terms of understanding how to measure psychological constructs. But then, of course, within particular selection setting and understanding the context of personal selection, the purpose, you know, the principles that surround the application of testing, not just the technical parts, but it is that as well. So I feel also extremely fortunate for that training. It's a no-brainer to contribute back to the university, and it's a real pleasure to work with people that from grad school that I still work with today. And then Lieta, who contacted me while I was in grad school. I distinctly remember staring out of the psychology building when she called to ask if I would co-author with her on an interview of psychology chapter. And my palms started sweating and I, you know, zoned out for what seemed like an hour, but was probably a couple seconds. And then I said, sure, let's go ahead and do that. And we met at a bar right off campus to hatch a plan. And everything great started from there in working with Lieta as a colleague on that project and then moving forward and until today even. So decades have passed, but it's been just phenomenal working with Lieta. And I'm happy to get into that further. I'll stop there.
So, Lieta, how many students did you have to ask before one said yes?
That's right.
Well, I'll explain. I asked Marv Donette and John Campbell who would be a good co-author, and they both said Fred. So I asked Fred, he said yes.
That sounds pretty good.
He's very careful, he's very smart, and he deals with information in precise ways. What could be better, right?
Wow. Tara, I think you're on to something though, Tara. I may be on lists, but that is honestly a good point. There are so many great talents in our field, and we're lucky for that. And we can't do it ourselves. And relevant to your book, Tara and Richard, like, you know, we need to grow more folks with IO skills to work together with us and build our part of a community that's multidisciplinary, wherever we go, machine learning and technology or disability and DEI issues or non-cognitive personality variables, right? We need lots of people thinking differently about these issues and working together on these issues.
As we say, I like Fred's statement, thinking differently, new ideas, new ways, being open-minded to new ways of thinking. That's so important. And Fred does that really well.
He does. So you both mentioned Minnesota in your introductory comments. How much do you think that Minnesota as a place or as an experience shaped your identity in terms of the why of what you do?
Fred, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, I'll try here. Obviously, I didn't have a control group, right? But I do have convergence with others with similar training that converge on the why we do what we do. And I think with our training is more being selection focused. We're focused on individual differences. But I think our training also, because it's broad, helps us understand that situations matter as well. So there's always this kind of battle between the social and the social psychologists who think about group differences and the differential psychologists think about individual differences, the prone box two disciplines of psychology notion. But really, both matter. Both account for 30% of the variance or whatever, however you want to frame it, but they both matter. And as we think about training and selection together, my training in Minnesota has helped me to think about that approach in an integrated way and not just in a kind of conceptual framework, although it is that. Also, how do you get into the weeds and do it? How do you design measures that will be reliable and valid? And how do you know? It's nice enough to say those things, but how do you know when you have it? And this will become increasingly challenging in the era of machine learning. I can't say. I think Minnesota has trained me to give me sensibility around those issues, but obviously there wasn't machine learning then. There were computers. Not as great as we had today, let's put it that way. But they were better than punch cards. So over to you, Lieta.
I'm familiar with punch cards.
Yeah, yeah. Keep improving.
Why do I do what I do? I don't spend a lot of time thinking about why I do things, but I love problem solving. And my career seems to have been series of problems that I've needed, that someone comes with to me with a problem that needs solving. And I love that. I love exploring. I love being a detective. I love gathering information and using that. And then I love measuring things. I love gathering data to answer questions that solve some kind of real world issue, or help to anyway. They don't often solve much, but they help.
You know, Leanna, I'll add to that to say, just resonating with the why we do what we do is, you know, I really like the science practice kind of bridge that we talk about. And in less abstract terms, sometimes that means taking research and folding it into a problem being solved, like you're saying, like, how do I solve this problem? And here's a tool that we're taught or we've learned about or has been shown to be useful in our practice, and you bring that in, and it's like a dose of medicine without telling them that necessarily that this is science, right? But it's something we know that can be useful in the practice setting. And sometimes there's a negotiation where you're solving a practice issue that way, but then you're also getting some research out of it. You're getting some data out of it, and your practitioners you're working with can be collaborators with you on the research side. So all that is to say, I really enjoy those exchanges as an academic with those in practice to try and solve a problem, but then do some interesting research.
For a practitioner, I've published a lot, but one of the reasons I've published, it's not because I needed to. In fact, it was kind of took away time from what I was, my real job was supposed to be. But I was lucky enough to be gathering information, doing research, developing new techniques, new tools, new measurements, new whatever, to gather data that was useful to the world out there in terms of selection and promotion. And one of the first things that I got, and it seems that so much of my career has revolved around developing measurements of people that could be used in personnel selection and promotion that would have less adverse impact against minorities or protected classes or women. And that I gathered information and developed new ways of thinking about some things that I felt would be helpful for my colleagues, other practitioners to know, because that would be a way of helping address some societal issues. And so my publishing career was really based on trying to inform others in our field about ways in which we as a field could help address some society's problems. That's been my motivation of why I kind of done some of the things I've done.
Let me skip ahead to our question list because, you mentioned the scientist practitioner bridge. So one of you is primarily academic and the other is primarily practitioner, but neither of you fit perfectly into either category. And you've both blurred that line really successfully. So can you say some more about the issues that you've run into while you are sort of navigating those challenges and navigating that bridge? How has it changed the approach to your work that you take?
Ed, do you want to go first?
That's a challenging question. I'll touch on some issues that I think we all, Taryn, Richard, you've encountered as well, as with working with practitioners, some of the barriers you might face. Is both it's a practical challenge, but it opens up some scientific opportunity as well, some research opportunity. So an example would be a practitioner is totally willing to work with you, to administer some new measures, say, for selection purposes, but they're only going to give you 15 minutes of testing time. So what do you do? Are you going to try and measure four things with really short measures, or one thing with the full 15 minutes, or what are you going to do? And I found across projects, that was a pretty common problem. So if you look at one set of my work, it's around shortening measures. And it is not the most theoretical work, I would say, in the world, but it does take a systematic psychometric approach to develop measures that measure personality. We've done personality, we've done shortened SJTs, we shortened cognitive ability, and there's a natural trade-off with reliability and therefore validity to some extent. And the question is not that it does that. We know that mathematically. The question is how much, and how much can you, you know, if you have to choose among alternatives in a real world testing setting, you don't want to do nothing. So how can these shorter measures provide value when the organization has limited time? Now, granted, you could also have another interesting conversation where you don't necessarily assume that there's only 15 minutes. You say, look, maybe if I communicate the value of testing, they'll give me 20 minutes. But that's one challenge that I've found interesting in the science practice, is to figure that out. And then legal issues are clearly an issue, whether you can conduct the research at all, whether when you involve graduate students, can they publish? If they can't, that's a deal breaker, basically, that, you know, students have to be able to publish and share the work. So sometimes you have conversations about, hey, this is an opportunity for an organization to be a thought leader and work with academics and try and promote the general issues and have a conversation about why this is good, and you're not going to reveal any privacy or proprietary issues necessarily. So having those conversations, and that helps communicate the value of IO, not just the value of your own specific project or the value of you. It lets organizations know that we can provide general valuable services in informing practice, but then also future research, which hopefully, if it improves, continues to help practice, and the cycle continues. So,
as I think about that, I think some couple things come to mind, but one was an instance when I was volunteering my time, and I thought, you know, this was really, but at that point in my career, I knew quite a bit, and these people should be really thrilled that I would help for nothing. And it turned out they really didn't want me. So what I mean to say is they didn't want my ideas for how I could help change their police department. And I thought I had some innovative strategies. And there was a colleague who was also donating her time, and she had much more traditional ways of approaching the situation. And they decided they didn't want to go with my ideas. And the police department was under terrific pressure to change its ways. And I knew that what was going to happen would be just a repeat of the problems they'd had generated for themselves already. And I ended up deciding not to continue working with them. And that was a very difficult decision, because if I had persisted, you know, I might have changed the future for that department. And I didn't. I quit. I gave up. And that, at times, regret that. But that's probably, it is an option. If you don't think that you're going to be successful, maybe you should back out. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that issue.
So So that specific ethical challenge has actually come up from my as a question from my grad students several times. Like, what happens when you have a client or a job in which you're being asked or led to do something that's not quite in alignment of your values? But is it truly that your options really are exit the situation entirely and then not have any influence at all on how that gets done, or stay in and try to maneuver through it? So that aligns really well with what my students have been concerned about. I'm wondering, Fred, have you had any of those kind of situations? Maybe in the government work, especially, there's a lot of restrictions there, right?
Yeah, there are definitely restrictions. Well, I'll give you one dramatic case. Was when we had done a lot of prep work for a grant, and this had to deal with the placement of language specialists in the military across the globe. So we'd done a lot of preparatory work for, it wasn't really, we had already had the grant in place, but we were getting things ready for the grant before it was really official and students were getting paid and things like that. So the point is, we were building up. And then what happened was, because the grant was not really through a research agency, but it was really more through like a general, like a commander, like one person, essentially, that one person left and another person came along and said, well, what is this grant? And we had to stop right away. And so they actually, this will never happen again. And they actually paid off the grant. So they were like, here's your salary for your students. But we don't want the work anymore. So what do you do, right? Wow. Because it isn't just about the funds. It's about students gaining the skills and moving forward. So fortunately, we could turn that lemon into some lemonade by taking those skills and applying them to another project in terms of selection, things that students have learned. But it was a very quick pivot to be able to do that. And I think, I mean, this also maybe speaks to graduate student research as well, which is where, you know, graduate students are in pre-tenured faculty. They're on shorter timelines, right, where they need to have payoffs. And so how do you create pivots when things aren't looking the way you thought they were going to look? How do you know where to turn or how to cut something short and to pursue another avenue? That's where you really do need a support network to help calibrate those decisions when you don't know the environment as well as you will moving forward. I think about that obviously a lot as an advisor. Fortunately, most situations are designed in the first place to be relatively structured and predictable, but they're not without some adventure, because it's also it's a controlled adventure, right? Students are supposed to have room to explore and make mistakes, but still with some structure. So
I appreciate that story, because you're pointing out that the work we do has stakes. It has consequences for people, organizations, students, people in general. And we wanted to ask you about stakes because Lieta, you do a lot of work with expert witness testimony, which, I mean, talk about stakes. So how do you approach a task like that where you know that the consequences are so intense for people and that your work really has these direct impacts?
The work I've been doing in terms of expert witness work is like a high wire act without a safety net. It is really frightening at times. And it's frightening because this is, and I've just recently learned this is kind of dumb, but it's been frightening for me because I work alone and I have to sign these non-disclosure agreements and that I won't reveal anything to anybody. And so I can't ask colleagues, do you think this is reasonable? No, I can't do that. But I've learned recently that I needn't be so distressed, I guess is the right word, about that, because I can, turns out, ask people, but I can ask in a hypothetical. But anyway, so that's been an interesting learning experience. But how do I approach it? Well, The first thing is to really get on top of the material and to be really understand what's going on in the, what the, usually I'm brought in recently are gender pay equity class action lawsuits. And my expertise for this is measuring work and the Equal Pay Act. These are the cases in California are the Equal Pay Act is that you should be paying people the same with, you can of course pay people differently based on their experience, their level of expertise, their performance, their legitimate reasons to pay people differently. But all that held constant, if they're performing substantially the same work, they should be paid the same. And so I have to be very much on top of what the work analysis of the opposing expert has done, or what the work that the company has done to get to that point. And so I would say, be prepared. It's the best thing to reduce one's chances of screwing up, not being reasonable.
That is great advice.
Be prepared, yeah. So that's, for me, that's been the single most important thing. But then being able to, once you've identified what's going on, to be able to go into the literature and find other strategies for how this could have been done. And so being a detective, one in what's presented to you, but also in what's in the literature, and using perhaps different ways of analyzing the data or that have not been done this way, typically. That the literature in other areas in our field or other fields in general suggest that this would be appropriate. So searching far and wide for alternative ways of approaching something, but really doing the homework is really key.
If it's okay with you both, I want to go backwards in our question list for a minute. So you've both been Iowa psychologists for a long time. I would expect that it's become a central part of your identity, but I would love to know what you were like before you were an Iowa psychologist. And did you know what you were getting yourself into when you pursued this career path?
I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I applied to graduate school in Iowa and was accepted. And then as school is about to start, I realized I had no idea. I was about to go to graduate school for several years, and I had no idea what this was. So at the University of Minnesota, they had Personnel Decisions Incorporated. It was a company that Marv Donat had founded. And so he suggested that I work there part-time. And go to school part-time. So I started right away learning what Iowa was and began doing all kinds of interesting things. And as a result, it took me a long time to graduate because I really liked what I was doing. But I had no idea what I was getting into. What was I like in those days? Probably quite similar to what I am today. I still am fearless. What I do.
So I also had absolutely no idea what I was doing. You know, I started in undergraduate with engineering, mainly because my mental model of majors that were out there was extremely limited. And I knew that engineering would lead to hopefully a gainful employment. We all make those kinds of decisions. And then turning to psychology was definitely a risk. I don't know if it was a calculated risk. It was just felt like a risk. But the reason I explored the social sciences and left engineering was I had friends who were juniors and seniors in engineering whose heads were in the books and they weren't doing much else. And despite, I would not consider myself an extrovert in the least, but seeing that kind of intensity made me feel like that was not for me. I wanted a balance of a quantitatively oriented future, but that also worked with people. And also maybe there was a little bit of not seeing the direct relevance, which I put the blame of that on me, not on the field of engineering. It just didn't feel that right for me. So I, despite having no financial safety net, I gritted my teeth and moved over to psychology and checked that out and took courses, eventually took IO psychology and individual differences. For IO psychology, we used Frank Landy's book. Very interesting. Made me realize that here was a job that was quantitatively oriented, as IO can be, that you could be paid, that they're even with a master's, it's feasible. And that's kind of how I proceeded. I didn't really systematically research graduate schools as much as I see a lot of applicants today who are, they just seem really well prepared. They may not know either exactly where they're going to be headed, but they're so much more well prepared. So I have lucked out so many ways at so many times in life. I feel extremely fortunate. And here we are on GIG. So, I mean, this is the pinnacle.
That's how you know you really made it.
I'd like to add that when I decided I needed to go to graduate school, it was because I couldn't become gainfully employed. In those days, I couldn't be a nurse because I hadn't taken nursing. I couldn't be a social worker because I hadn't taken that. There was nothing I could do other than be a secretary. So I decided graduate school was for me.
Well, one thing that gave me confidence before graduate school, out of anything, family, friends, et cetera, was being a good employee. So I worked at Walmart. I worked at Red Lobster. I worked at a tropical fish warehouse of all things. And in all these contexts, they said, you know, you're a good employee. And from that, I just felt like, okay, no matter where I go or what I do, I know I will be a good worker wherever I go. That made me feel good. You know, it gives you a sense of some security moving into any of these situations. Because what's the worst case? Grad school doesn't work out. You can find a job somewhere and probably do well. So that was my safety net.
Now I want to reflect on this a little bit more. So, you know, you both talked about this process of thinking about who you would become and not really being sure, but thinking about your qualifications and your characteristics and your interests. And so I have to ask, how much of your subsequent work on personality do you think could be categorized as me search?
Interesting question.
let me explain a little bit, and then you all can decide whether this is me search or not. But I'd say in working with Lietta, one thing that has been really exciting as we keep thinking about personality is that it's going beyond the big five, right? There's sort of this pendulum swing in our research, I would say. And you can look at personality, you can look at ability in our field, you can look at motivation, but there's sort of a pendulum swing where when sample sizes are small, you need to find some stability around these correlations that are bouncing around because we're overfitting our models to our data, right? And so the early days of meta-analysis was to say, forget about situations and forget about the refined constructs. We just need to find something and average these effects. And, you know, that's where broader constructs come to be, whether it's a general factor for ability or whether it's the big five. It's a less refined, it's not to say that those are not useful. Of course, they have context in place, but it's to say that when you start having larger samples and you start thinking more carefully about situations and context and what exactly are you trying to predict, by the way, in a selection context, then you start looking in a more refined way and you say, okay, if I have large samples and I actually do good measurement, you can get at any, it's always an empirical question as to whether the construct is distinct or not empirically and in terms of incremental prediction and so on. But you can try, you can go to these attempts. And so we've kind of headed in that direction as a field. You can see that in meta-analysis when there's much more discussion now of moderators and random effects, right? And not just looking at, not saying situations don't matter, things like that. And so in working with Lietta, this happened, our discussions happened at the same time there was a push toward greater refinement. And I found that very helpful. And also in working with Lietta, if you can't tell yet, I mean, it's just fun. It is just fun to work with Lietta and explore ideas. There are no egos. There's a lot of careful listening. We work well together for a variety of reasons. We're not wedded to our words. We just pass things back and forth and see what, you know, keep iterating, care about the work, and have fun while doing it. So I wanted to get that in while we were on the air here.
Let me push a little on the word fun. So okay. I think a lot of people looking at grad school, that doesn't factor much into their decision is the enjoyment part. A lot of especially these days is about like, what's the career that's going to get me employed? And it's hard to even imagine what would be fun. Like imagining how the day to day would be enjoyable. Has that driven your decision making in terms of career, or is that just a result? It's like, oh, and look, it's fun. Or was that something you were actively trying to create along the way?
That's a great question. I was looking to create it along the way. I won't say that everything I am doing is a fun fest, but I will say that if you look at where I've published and what I'm doing, it's pretty broad. And that's because I think it's, you know, your career is in, to some extent, a personality reflection of your personality. Like I like looking at different things and connecting across different ideas. I don't do the same thing again and again, although I'm still in the ballpark of individual differences and methods and selection. But I like doing different things. Like I like being an editor. There are a lot of things I'm terrible at in terms of outside of IO, but even within IO, right? We all have our profile of things we are good at and things we don't do and aren't fun. But I'd say the breadth approach is fun. So I like working with different people and with different ideas, and I like exploring a bit. And that's reflected in my advising grad students as well, that sort of explore versus exploit, that you need to publish, there's something to be said for early on really knowing, you know, going in depth on a topic and publishing, but don't, you know, try and diversify a little bit, if only to see where your future fit will be. And there's also a reason, it's almost like the stock market, right? Why do we diversify a portfolio? It's to hedge our bets and capitalize on the market where we can. You could look at it that way in terms of grad school. If you were going to be a little less fun, a little more instrumental, you might say, let's figure out multiple areas. You can't do everything, but I'm more on the explore side of, kind of advising, but I appreciate people that are also more focused in an area and a depth approach.
Lietta, are you more explore or exploit?
Oh, I'm definitely explore. One of the things I love working with Fred is that we do enjoy each other, and I can't put my finger on why, but I can try. And it is Fred's really open-minded, and I really like that. We brainstorm. We don't have any concerns about, oh, that's a dumb idea, you know. Okay, we'll build on something. And that's fun. It's extremely enjoyable. The other part is that Fred has incredible integrity, intellectual integrity, and I trust him. And that you can trust Fred on many, many levels. And that's not necessarily relating to the fun, but it makes you at ease. And that's really key. And he writes really, really well, and he's really smart. So,
this is a great warm up to Valentine's Day tomorrow, by the way. Thank you. I do sincerely appreciate it. I think the same of you, Lietta, that I can't exactly put my finger on it, but the open-mindedness is connected with the explore side of our field to see what's out there. And then, you know, once you explore, analyze, you know, take a systematic approach to your discoveries, you know, that kind of process and working through those things with you has been extremely rewarding.
Well, I really appreciate you both saying that, that you haven't felt confined to just work on one sort of thing or worry too much about too much exploiting. I think it's common advice for students and for early career people that they should pick a thing and just worry about that thing. And I also think that's terrible advice, but it's leading me to my next question, which is, what is the best advice career-wise that you've received? And then also, what is the worst advice that you've received? Especially if you ignored that advice, we would love to hear what that is.
I don't remember getting any career advice.
Oh. I remember some early career advice before I chose IO psychology, and that was from my best friend's mom as I was considering a major in undergrad. She was a therapist, and with that came some calmness in giving advice. And you know, as I was panicking about a major and my future, I guess, she calmly said, you know, you are multi-potential. You have a lot of different things you can do. And whatever you choose to do, you'll be good at. And I think she said something about how monks will, you know, people will come to a temple to become a monk. The monks that are there will give somebody a broom and they're asked to sweep the monastery. And the whole goal is not really to clean the monastery, although it is that. The goal is to concentrate and do something well, no matter what you're doing. And I don't know, for whatever is in there, the point stuck with me that, hey, I'll pick something, I'll get into it. And it is sort of an exploit side, but it's the entire field of whatever you choose, right? As opposed to other fields. And it did make me more comfortable and confident to pursue a psychology like career as I was moving from engineering to psychology.
Well, I just love that Lietta is such a trailblazer that nobody could even give her advice because no one's ever seen anything like that. That's just amazing.
That's as I think about it, I didn't get career advice, but when I was growing up, I was taught, it was the culture in my family, my parents, that you were expected to do the very best you can. It might not be good enough, but do the very best you can always. And that has been an important principle, because you can be sweeping the floor at the monastery, but do it the best you can. It turns out sometimes people notice that you swept the floor well. And it leads to other things. They will give you other opportunities. So doing your best is part of being prepared too. Anyway.
Is that the state motto for Iowa, by the way? There are so many Iowa psychologists from Iowa, I wonder if the state motto is do the best you can. And that's why we have Iowan legends in Iowa psychology.
So one theme, I think, that's emerged in this conversation and often emerges in discussions about people's careers is the role of serendipity and people taking advantage of moments or relationships or whatever it might be. The shape of that has changed a lot over the years. And we now have a lot of people coming up in what we might now call like a non-traditional graduate education environment, coming from programs where it's not as common to like run into someone in the halls who says, hey, why don't you come work on this project? Hey, how about, I heard about this job. What do you think about that? There's just less opportunity for connection. I'm wondering if you have thought about, well, maybe not have you thought about it. I'm wondering if you have a prediction or reflection on if you started all over right now in the current environment, what might have been different for you and how might that have changed the trajectory you ended up on?
I think when I started in graduate school and in the career as an Iowa psychologist, I don't know, the sky was the limit. There were so many things in our field that were open. I have a sense that they're not as open anymore, that you can't be moving around from one specialty to another. I don't know for sure because I'm not, you would, all three of you would know more than I about that. But I feel that it's more closed now than it was. And when I was first starting out, the field was much younger. And there were so many opportunities that I don't know how often you have research institutes where graduate students can gain training in the field. I know that Humro, of course, is a wonderful place for that kind of experience, but I don't know that there are that many of them. I don't know. Do you guys know?
I think it speaks to the need to understand where people are today when they search out their majors and careers, right? That's a broad question we might be interested in as an Iowa psychologist, but focusing on our own profession, kind of having the same interview we're having now with everybody, like where are you going and why in Iowa psychology and what are the skills you need to move forward and what is real, what is perceived, what are demands for our skills that could be generated, cultivated further, right? To let organizations know of the benefits of Iowa psychology more. So not just serving the field, but being proactive and stimulating where we can have more opportunities in the AI space, as AI is more relevant in the workforce, we can inform decisions organizations are making with the vendors they might consider. I know Richard and Tara, you all have written about that and where IO would matter in the auditing process of AI tools. That's just one example, but a really important one, a modern one. And so I think anybody thinking about IO today would need to be thinking about those future-oriented contexts and the skills that are required for them. And they have so many other options available to them today. I just wonder, when does an IO PhD option seem the most appealing to them versus a master's versus an online master's versus a business school versus other adjacent disciplines or people that want to go all tech all the time, right? Like I myself, among the majors I thought about as an undergrad was computer science, right? And so you can be in computer science and still deal with workplace issues. And that's where multidisciplinary comes in is where, how can we reach out to those people and keep bridging across disciplines and research and practice.
I think you're making a really good point, Fred. And I think that I was a bit negative about the current situation, but IO psychologists are sought after now. It's a field where it's one of the most popular for young people to be looking at. And the new opportunities in AI, I mean, it is. It's another golden age, probably, for IO.
It's sort of an internal version of the future of work problem, right? So the IO that exists right now and will exist a few years from now, hard to know what it is. And I don't know, I think it's causing a lot of new entrants into the field, a lot of angst to try to figure out how they fit into an equation that's changing. Usually we frame that in terms of like the workforces that we advise or help with, but it's also our own. You know, IO is itself changing. Do you have any advice on how they can navigate it? A lot of these solutions seem higher level, like they're things that the established folks can maybe try to do to help ease the path. But as a new graduate or somebody even looking at grad school, do you have any recommendations for them?
I should probably be the first to respond, but that is a really challenging question. Some generic advice I give to anyone applying to graduate school is to look at those who are in graduate school, the programs they're interested in, to see what kinds of topics they're involved in, to see if they're interesting and relevant. And of course, I think it's safe to assume that research is always adapting to the outside world, maybe not as fast as we would hope, but you see a topic and you're like, hey, I can contribute to that. I come in with some, you know, new ideas and they'll be shaped by a graduate program. But as long as graduate students seem happy and productive within a particular department, as long as it seems like you can have a productive relationship with an advisor, that's great. But also, you're not just a passive recipient of a program. You're an active contributor and can bring in modern ideas. And we need that to keep IO current. That's why I'm glad at Rice University, where we have a new master's program, and I see that helping our PhD program, because we can see what is happening in practice and how that makes research relevant, but then in turn, how can research be responsive to the needs out there? You've heard this before in many other contexts, right? But I think that's a formula that can work and can keep our programs current. We need more of them, I would say. When we think of psychology programs, often what comes first to mind is clinical and counseling and social and cognitive. And IO is probably not on some people's lists, or it's low on their list, when really we do have such an impact on the world. We really, there's a lot of student interest in what we do, and we could probably cultivate that more at our, you know, as a signal. I'm not saying that the Harvards and the Stanfords are necessarily where we need to have all our influence, but having an IO area within Ivies or elite institutions is a signal to say we are a discipline that matters. And I think we need that. There's a wide range of master's programs online that vary in their quality. I think that we can't just have that as the future of our field. We need to upgrade, understand the nature of those programs, because there are so many coming out of them. But we need to integrate that, I guess, is my point, with development of PhD programs as well, so that there is this bridge we keep talking about between science and practice that we care about, where the master's students who are going into practice, almost exclusively they go into practice, can bridge with stronger and more PhD programs that focus on research.
I'm curious, Lieta, do you think the science practice tie, gap, however you want to frame it, has changed over the years? Is it worse now, or is that just something that we complain about?
it's a wonderful model. I love it. I just can't believe how wonderful a model it is. You get to apply things, you discover things, and you get to use them out there in the real world, and you get to help solve some problems organizations or people are experiencing or society. It's a wonderful model. I guess that's not the question.
What I wonder is how much it's a choice, because basically everything you've said it exemplifies that approach. And I don't know that all training is like that. I don't know that all people make that choice to continuously make that integration. It relates to this kind of identity concept. It sounds like something that you've very actively curated, like over your whole career, to as has Fred, to constantly be bringing them together. But I wonder what advice to give to people to encourage them to do the same.
Advice, identify problems, be problem solving. So I don't know a better way to solve problems than bring to bear research or evidence or empirical data to solve problems. And creativity, problem solving in my mind is a form of creativity. Maybe it's in how one frames the gig or the assignment you're working on, and whether or not you can see it in a broader context to enable the scientist practitioner thinking. I don't know, really.
So I think you nailed it, because the challenge is that so many young people say they don't like research, but what's actually the case is that they don't have any interesting puzzles to solve, and so they don't see how research can be useful to them. And as soon as they learn about a puzzle and they can see how getting information to solve that puzzle would be valuable, their tune changes entirely, and then they love research. So I think we can do more to make sure that people see that connection, but also know about the puzzles. Like, what are the big puzzles? What are the grand mysteries that we don't know the answers to right now? And the more that we can share that with young people entering the field, the more they will be motivated to become the next generation of Freds and Liettas, which we desperately need.
We need more Freds and Liettas, it sounds like.
Yes.
Thank you. I think that's right. I think the understanding what the tools are used for is key. At the same time, with time, you understand the problems better, right? The more you are in the field, the more you have perspective on the problems to be solved. And at some level, then it's very helpful to work with people who have more experience and learn from them. And also just have some faith and confidence in yourself that as you move along in your career, you have to persist, as Lietta said, to keep trying to do your best, because the payoffs are this downstream perspective, deeper perspectives you're going to gain by committing your precious time and effort to these types of issues.
That is it for gig number 27. So thank you again to Lietta Fred for joining us. Thank you, dear viewer, also for joining us. Remember to like, subscribe, visit our website, go forth and do good. See you next time. Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye, everyone.
That's it for another gig. To stay in touch, subscribe on YouTube, check out our website at thegig.online, join our LinkedIn group, sign up for our email notification list, and join our Discord. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time for another great IO get-together.